TMA and FTMA at the same time in T25.
Wow.
I'm going to ask you for a couple of words on that. Also, when it comes to super weak signal reception, I used to think that the state-of-the-art there was the Joe Taylor technique, the WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor technique, K1JT, Reed Solomon and other kinds of... his system, I think, consists of four separate tones that are sent in certain combinations, which give you the whole alphabet and the whole number system. It may be a little bit of punctuation there, I'm not true, but I hear numbers like minus 28 dB signal-to-noise ratio can still allow you with the WSJT technique to get the message through. So I wonder, Joe, have you used any of the Joe Taylor techniques? Because that is also a quasi-digital mode from my point of view. KC2, UGB, K2LAW, TechNet.
KC2, UBG, Friday. Yes, I've used them all. I've tested them all. I've listened to them all. There is a great solution which is very, very interesting for some people. The T25 is primarily for law enforcement, fire department, government. That's supposedly those based on Motorola's design. And there's also, that is an open design, whereas DMR is made from a committee, so it's specifically specific for them. They have motor turbo. There is also with time difference, just to recap on what he was talking about, time and the speed of it. The difference, motor turbo versus a company called like Hytera or like a cheap Chinese company, they have a standard, and Motorola does a little bit different in which they do things. There is a solution also to combine with the repeater, which is called a C-bridge. A C-bridge is also a thing that links other repeaters together, almost like a form of internet connection, but for the DMR solution for either businesses or ham radio community based on, which is different from, like, say, the different things from D-Star, where you need an internet connection at the location of that site, which is very interesting. But the solutions are, many are out there, and they're all great. And the Fusion and T25 are very interesting ways of going about it. Not a lot of people are on these systems. D-Star and DMR are probably the most popular at this time. But, you know, different situations, I believe that every digital form has its props. I mean, for long distances, I think D-Star is amazing because it was built for ham radio. For ham radio, it's not used for anything else but that. I'll bet you back. Okay, back to the TDMA is great for UHF practices because of its bandwidth. You have to understand also, when you use these modes, the bandwidth is very limited on like 2 meters versus where it is on 440. TDMA works great on those bands, even for businesses. Most businesses use around from 400 to 700 to 800 and 900, that kind of area, because they have a lot more bandwidth.
I wonder if you're using these digital modes in your place of business, Joe. Also, when I go to QSZ.com and put in your call letters, by the way, your Uncle Bravo Golf, I'll bet you a lot of people hear you as Uncle Golf Bravo. That's what I heard at first. There's a picture of you with a guitar. It looks to me like you're also into music, but when it comes to digital modes of communication, does that have something to do with your business, Joe? Go ahead.
No, this was just a form of technology that I wanted to go into. I'm primarily an expert in satellite communication and also forms of cellular connectivity that we use on a daily basis, whether the LTE, LTE bands, HSDA, GSM, you know, the UCDMA, that kind of technology I am more into. And this was just an extension of that, and so it allowed me to do it with the ham radio and stuff like that. But there was a great, you know, I want to go on a topic with satellite and the newest satellite communications that's happening with LTE communications using latest beamforming technology, which has greatly improved digital communication.
Joe, you sound like an engineer. I wonder if you've had engineering training and engineering experience, or were you one of these unusual guys that selects a subject, digs in real deep, and doesn't even worry about whether or not he's had formal education in that. So how have you acquired all of this smarts in this area, Joe? KC2. Uncle Bravo Golf, T2RAW. Go ahead, Joe.
KC2OIS, looking for a radio check. I just changed my radio.
Computer technology person, I guess you could say an engineer or a hacker of some sort, and just probably getting into this. I was into, so I was very interested in how, radio really relates to what digital communication, because you can talk about radio all day long and talk about how it jumps off the antenna, but after it jumps off that antenna and how it gets into my radio or my cell phone or my dish that's on top of my roof, how does that work and how does that communicate fluidly and how does it automatically do things and, figure out what has to be done?
Yeah, what I think you're saying, Joe, is you're also mystified like most of us are as to what is a radio wave, what does it really consist of. All the formal education will tell you it is a TEM wave in free space, transverse electromagnetic. That it's got an electrical component, and at right angles it's got a magnetic component, and the direction of propagation is exactly at right angles to both of those. And by some means, that packet of energy, radio energy, leaves your transmitting antenna, can travel through the hottest vacuum of space in the world, like between us and the Voyager spacecraft, or between us and the Apollo astronauts on the moon. That signal gets there, even though it's going through a medium that seems to be nothing. Maybe it's got some phlogiston, if you know what I mean. So what radio really is, I think, is one of the driving mysteries that a lot of us have asked. And even though there's some fancy equations, Maxwell's equations, and fancy books written on the subject, still an awful lot of us, and I'm one of them, doesn't have a warm, fuzzy feeling as to what is really going on. So a whole bunch of ham radio experiments. Let me drop. A whole lot of ham radio experiments. We found out what works, what doesn't work. This kind of an antenna works in that application, and you can squeeze it down, and you get this response, and so on. So we've got a whole lot of rules of thumb. A person with a lot of antenna design experience really builds up a whole lot of rules of thumb over the 10 or 20 years of his apprenticeship required for him to become skilled in that area under normal circumstances. And the way it's taught in the books and the schools leaves a lot to be desired, in my opinion. So there's a lot of mystery there. Let me go back to Rich, though, with one of the things that he is doing that an awful lot of us listening might not know about. Let me drop. With his rig, his GX60B, I think it is, Rich desires full break-in capability. Those words roll off the tongue real easily. But among the highly skilled hams of 20, 30 years ago, full break-in capability means that when you're sending Morse code, and you press down the key and you send a dash, and you lift up the key and then send a dot, those empty spaces in between the dash and the dot, you've got a transmit-receive relay system on your transmitter and receiver that operates fast enough, and if the receiver is not being desent by your own transmitter leakage power, it is possible in those empty spaces to hear the other guy. So you're sending high-speed code to him, and a certain portion of what you're sending to him, he didn't get it. He starts sending to you while you're sending, and he says, please repeat all after word walking, if you know what I mean. And so in those dead spaces, you can hear him while you're transmitting. So even though you think transmitting of Morse code is a simplex operation, properly done, it has duplex capability. You can hear while you're transmitting in those empty dead spaces. And that's what Rich wants to do. It's a very sophisticated kind of ham radio. It's hard to believe that people were doing that 20 and 30 and 40 years ago by using very high-speed electromechanical relays, because I don't think they had solid-state diodes that could do it in, say, 1965. But people in 1965 were doing full duplex. And I wonder how much full duplex Morse code you have done, Rich, and what got you into that? It's a very sophisticated kind of Morse code that very few people today talk about. W2GSM, K2LAW, the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, I started out with CW back in 1970 with the DX60. And the DX60B is just my passion, my obsession. I know modern transceivers have full break in CW. You can just get one of them and go in the air and you're done. That's all right, but I'm obsessed with this. I've seen lots of different circuits. I've seen lots of relay-based circuits in different boxes that use it. Noisy, and of course the relays will wear out. PIN diodes or TR or high-power diodes is another matter. I haven't seen a lot of circuits like that. I've seen a bunch of things discussed in old ARL handbooks, but I'm trying to zero in on this one, John. And I thank Eric for the leads on W2, and it's going to be a lot of good research. By the way, the research is a lot of fun by itself. I'm learning a lot about this. WV2 Golf X-ray mic. Back to TechNet.
Okay, you're WV2. I've been dropping the B. Sorry about that. And I thought I heard you say GX. It's the Delta X-ray dash 60. Delta X-ray dash 60B. Is that a Heathkit 1970 rig with a Pi output network and the tube in the final? Am I correct? Am I close there, Rich? Over to you, Rich.
Absolutely, Dick. It's a 6146 final output going into a Pi network. And I do understand that when the transmitter is not transmitting, that Pi network presents an impedance of essentially zero, which would suck out the receiver upon receive, which is part of the problem of trying to isolate the transmitter during receive.
Dick, I cut out my DX60. First transmitter I ever built. What year did you build that, Eric?
Yeah, I got my ticket when I was 11, so that makes it 1961.
Yeah, that company in Benton Harbor, Michigan, called Heathkit. Boy, did they make an awful lot of kits that became very popular in those days. By the way, the mailing address was Benton Harbor. They really dwelled in the town of Port St. Joe, Michigan. Not very well known. I have a relative that used to work for them. So, interesting company. Now, a Pi network takes the approximately 3,000 or 4,000 ohms of plate impedance of a 6146, that's the input of the Pi network, converts it down to 50 ohms going to your antenna, and does it at whatever frequency you're operating, 80, 40, 20, and so on. When you are not using that 6146 tube, and it's an open circuit, and you pour power back into that Pi network, you said it's a short circuit. I don't believe that.
Hey, it's a flywheel.
It's DPC with a comment. Yeah, it's going to be a highly reactive network. In other words, you know the amount of plate capacitance of the 6146. You know the amount of capacitance of your C1 capacitor of the Pi network. In theory, you can find out the amount of inductance of the coil. And you know the amount of capacitance of the C2 capacitor of the Pi network. Therefore, I've got a computer program, and there's various techniques by which you can calculate exactly what impedance that Pi network is going to give you when you look back into it. I am positive it is not a short circuit. If you told me that it's going to be highly capacitive at the operating frequency, I'd sort of believe that. I wonder if you've ever poured power back into a Pi network and measured the impedance with a vector network analyzer. Over to you, Hal, K6DPZ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
W in Techno, K6DPZ. I just happened to hear as part of it, I was working down the lab. Question. He wants to work break-in on CW. He has a DX60. I know DX60 very well. Very easy way of doing it. Couple very lightly off the plate of the 6146. And what you do, after you couple off light, you put any two down to ground. Protect the receiver input. And you can have TR switching very rapidly. I've done it.
Okay, if I asked all the people listening right now if they understood the whole sentence, they did not. Little to sampler, if I understand you correctly. You're going to have to give us a few more words. That was so brief that we know you're talking about connecting to the plate circuit, reconnecting to a receiver, and you're using any twos. Other than that, I don't know if we got much out of what you just said, Al.
I have a problem with that.
Yes, so do I. But let's see what Hal is trying to communicate with us. Hal, what you're saying is a beautiful, clear diagram in your head. The words coming out of your mouth did not convey that diagram. Make believe we are blind and you're trying to, with your voice, draw a picture for us as to that circuit you just described. The transmit function, the receive function, the isolation, there's a whole lot of missing information. K6DPZ, it was so brief, I didn't get it. K2LIW in the second half.
Okay, let's try it again. All right, basically what I'm saying is if you couple off with about 2-3 puffs of capacity off the plate of the 6146, and then off the other side of that cap, not on the plate side, but the other side of the cap, you put an NE2. The NE2 will fire and transmit. So basically, you'll present a short going into the antenna of the receiver. But in non-transmit mode, that slight coupling from the plate will give you receive capability on your, in your front end of your receiver. Go into the receiver, not going into the tuned circuit front end. You're going to put another tube in, lift it to a high impedance tube, and then go into your existing receiver and have a very high speed CW breaking.
Can I drive over here?
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to you in a minute, Eric. If the 6146 was running Class A and is continuously drawing current, it's going to make a mountain of noise into your receiver. It's going to desense the hell out of your receiver. If during your full break-in, you bias the 6146 completely off, then it can become quiet. I think that can work. Let's see what Eric's got to say on this. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Only the biased optic. It's opening the cathode.
Not everybody keys it that way. Some key the signal into the 6146 grid, so to speak. Over to you, Eric.
Here's where my problem is. Okay, we have a tank circuit. What's the purpose of a tank circuit? Besides an impedance match. Tube is running Class C, let's say, to do in CW, even Class AB1, but let's take Class C because it's easy. Okay, tube's only on for 180 degrees. That tank circuit, as that magnetic field begins to collapse, makes the collapse occur during that next period of time. So it is, in essence, the flywheel in terms of making output at the point in time where the tube is not in conduction. With what Cal's saying, I mean, I understand where he's going, but you still have to deal with that collapsing field. So, you know, you still have energy there. Yes, do you agree?
Believe it or not, Eric, I'm going to be on Hal's side on this one, which is rare. The 6146 tube plate circuit, tank network, high network, when you tie it, when you design it correctly, you're usually designed for a Q near 10, which means you could say it goes down to 1 over E of the amplitude in 10 cycles. Well, 10 cycles of, let's say, 14 megahertz is a very brief period of time, a certain number of microseconds, fraction of a microsecond. So yes, it's a flywheel. But that flywheel with a Q of 10 is going to die down very fast. Compared to human response time sending Morse code, that's not a problem. The Pi network is a beautiful bandpass filter, giving impedance match. The 6140, the antenna that you're connected to is now pouring a signal back in the receive mode. Through the Pi network, it's being converted to a much higher voltage and a much higher impedance at the plate. As Hal was telling us, if you're using cathode keying on the 6146, and maybe the DX60 does that, the tube is thoroughly non-conducting, no electrons coming out of it because the cathode is floating up in the air. When you lift up the key, let me drop the key. So therefore, the 6146 is not making noise, it's not active. The Pi network is doing its same conversion. It's giving you this high voltage that you're now coupling back with a couple of picofarad capacitor from the plate circuit of the 6146 into your receiver. The NE2 tube makes sure that the very little voltage per se gets into the receiver. The NE2 starts conducting at around 60 volts. And another back-to-back set of diodes on the receiver can give you some even further protection. But there way of making a very fast break in TR circuit that way. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say it's going to give you the world's best isolation, but it's a crafty way of using that plate tank circuit. You see what I'm saying here, Eric? With a Q of 10, that flywheel is not going to ring as anywhere near as long as you were worried about. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
I hear you. I agree with you, but here's where I have an issue. Let's say you're using a 3N128. How much voltage can you put on that gate for how long a period of time before you open it up?
All right, we're talking about tubes, not sets. And I did this with a comparable DX60, making fast TR switching. I went into a tubes grid, which is high impedance, and then coupled into the lower impedance, or cathode power, into the receiver's input impedance.
Hey, Al, but maybe you didn't hear him in terms of why he's doing this. If he uses a solid state receiver with his DX60, because he loves his DX60, he really didn't specify that he's using it. But assuming he's using a receiver which has a nice FET or a dual gate front end, and there's where I see a problem.
Yeah, I agree with you, Eric. However, if he's smart enough, after the NE2 and the 3 picofarad capacitor, 1 picofarad capacitor, if he then has on the front end of his FET receiver front end a pair of back-to-back Schottky diodes acting as a voltage limiter, so that now not much more than 4/10 of a volt peak can go into his FET transistor, I think he can have his cake and eat it too. In other words,
I'll go with that.
Yeah, the diodes are not going to be conducting when there's real signal there unless it's right next door to him. It's going to protect the receiver. And so there is a way that he can make a very simple circuit that could require a hell of a lot less, you know, all the real high power, let me drop it. All the high power switching diode network that Rich is in the process of coming up with can be simplified by this technique. And I think he can get full receiver sensitivity out of this. Yeah, the insertion loss of this total network, the Pi network and the picofarads and the neon tube and so on, it's going to have a couple of dB of insertion loss because the noise figure on HF bands is equivalent to a 20 dB noise figure. It's not going to hurt. In other words, it's going to cut down the signal a little bit. It's going to cut down the noise on the band, exact same amount. The signal to noise ratio will stay the same. So I see a possibility here of making a fully effective, extremely simple network with no high power switching diodes anywhere. Just those Schottky diodes back to back protecting his FET front end. Let's see if you've got any further words as to what you would suggest on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I'm a glutton for punishment. I would probably want to put a lumped element together and do it that way. And just use, you know, actually, I would probably wind up using three diodes in my mind. But then again, because I live in the solid state world, my world of tubes I've left behind many years ago. So that's my thinking. And besides, the switching times and the isolation that I can create is really very nice in that situation. And actually, if you've got any kind of an HF, solid state HF radio, you can literally lift it out of this schematic.
DBG.
Yeah, this circuit that Hal is suggesting has all the switching times ironed out automatically. The thing that's really doing the switching is the 6146. And when he lifts that cathode by lifting the key, and the tube is no longer conducting, you're now in the receive mode essentially instantaneously. That's a very crafty way of doing it. As you can tell Rich, there's multiple ways of solving the full break-in problem. Let's see what Joe's got to say on this. I'll bet you some of the digital circuits you've worked on, Joe, may use some of these techniques. KC2, UBG, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, sorry to break in there. I just put my own 2 cents. But the information that you're talking about with solid-state amplifiers is greatly information that is very relatable to ham radio and also HF radio. When you talk about, say the repeater we're on, and say we're using a linear amplifier to provide us with, you know, HF, or we're doing it for 2 meters to give us 100 watts out of the repeater. Well, there's also the other repeater, which is down the road, which maybe is down the road or down in Montauk, and we want to link those two machines up. a transistor-based amplifier would greatly benefit from this situation.
Okay, right now, Joe, I'm not quite sure what you're saying. You're talking about full break-in capability that aids the linking of repeaters. Maybe I'm mixing a facts here. Go ahead, Joe.
ACT, ABC, Friday. Sorry about that. When we talk about communication, and we talk about, we say, okay, we point a beam. Say we point a beam at one point, and we point a beam at the other. The latency between us from Nassau County, from all we distance from Suffolk County on 2 meters, or say 440, there is a great difference. There is a delay of difference when you're talking about analog communications as we are doing right now. So the difference between those two are greatly different. If you use a transistor-based amplifier, it greatly benefits the ability to have a duplex conversation as well as have a cross-link through two repeaters during transistor-based amplifiers. When you're using digital, preferably, let's take, for instance, Motor Turbo or DMR or D-Star, that kind of benefit greatly improves the communications, not only for analog, but for digital communications, either FDMA and TDMA.
When it comes to latency, now, at the speed of light, you use 6 nanoseconds for each nautical mile. In other words, if my transmitter and receiver are separated by 1 nautical mile, roughly 6,000 feet, 6 microseconds takes place between the transmit and receive. That's 1 mile. 10 miles would be 60 microseconds. 100 miles would be 600 microseconds. 0.6 is a millisecond. So that if you want to make a full duplex circuit with some significant number of miles between transmitter and receiver, and you want to be able to hear in between the dots and dashes, so to speak, with high-speed digital, you've got to worry about that latency. Is that part of what you were saying, Joe? Over to you, Joe, KQRIW.
That's correct. There's a great story that goes on in the stock market industry when back in the day. And what was happening was they wanted to have a connection that went from New York to Chicago in order to communicate with different offices in Chicago and New York during the stock times that are during the day. Well, they tried to do things with fiber optics. And so Einstein said that, well, you can, if you have light in a straight line, it's the fastest. Light is the fastest, right? He was wrong at some point, but he was a little bit fibbing in some times. He was, he says, yes, that's true, but when you bend light and it slowly goes away, the speed slowly goes down. When you take a fiber optic cable and you bend it, the actual speed of the fiber optics go down considerably. And so when we go down a road, we don't put it in a straight line from here to point A to point B. There's roads, there's buildings, there's switches, there's hubs. In order to do that, the speed is slowly growing down. So let me, hold on.
XM.
I'll give it back to the other one in a second. So what they did was they figured that they put out this fiber cable and tried to put it in a straight line, but it didn't work. It was still a delay. So what they did was they put a series of towers between those two. A series of them, not just one, not just two, but a whole series of them, all in different angles and in different ways. So what happened was, once the signal hits one tower, it relays that signal to another tower, another tower, and another tower. And so the speed was actually so fast that they were able to do what they needed to do and have the full amount of bandwidth that we was able to do even in the stock market industry.
Yeah, I think you're talking about high-speed trading techniques. Is something we've been hearing about over the last few years. Joe, I know you wanted to add something, all of the above. WD2GSM, or is it D? Is it Whiskey Delta 2 GSM? Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
I'm thinking about what Hal described earlier. I'm having a little trouble visualizing the schematic. Help.
Okay. He was using the Pi network backwards in the receive mode. The Pi network, the output of the Pi network is continuously connected to his antenna with no TR relay. So when the 6146 out of your DX60 is driving that Pi network, you're transmitting, no problem. assuming you're using cathode key on the 6146, when you lift up the key, the cathode is no longer grounded, the tube is now thoroughly not working, and then the tube itself might be running Class C. So without drive, again, the tube is inactive. Now the antenna, doing a reception of signal, is pulling back through the Pi network in reverse. The signal at the plate of the 6146 is now a much higher voltage. Whatever the, assuming now that the plate impedance was, let me pick a number, 3,000 ohms, and the output impedance of your Pi network is 50 ohms, you take the square root of that ratio, that's the voltage buildup, and it might be a 10 to 1. So actual, the voltage coming down your antenna, hitting the Pi network, is going to become 10 times higher in voltage, in my crazy example, at the plate circuit. It's a higher impedance, but it's a higher voltage. And now, by sampling a little bit of that signal with a couple of picofarad capacitors, and coupling that with or without that neon tube, you're giving protection. The real protection is going to come from your back-to-back Schottky diode. So that couple of picofarad sampling capacitors pours the signal into your receiver front end. The receiver front end is continuously active with a pair of Schottky back-to-back diodes in front of it to protect it. So now that circuit is an automatic TR switch. You lift up the key, you're now in the receive mode. The only thing wrong with that circuit is while you're transmitting, the total amount of signal getting into your receiver will not be enough to damage it, but the signal will be strong enough that you receive...
Repeater, time out.
I still have the bias, the Schottky diode.
Okay, with or without bias on the Schottky diode. Without bias on the Schottky diode, you're going to get 3/10 of a volt or 4/10 of a volt, and that's not going to damage the set receiver, I believe.
Passing into the diode.
Yeah. Agreed. If you use the right kind of high-speed Schottky diodes, the capacitance they add is a small fraction of a picofarad on 50 ohms at HF frequency. That's not serious. Yes, you could also, while you're transmitting, apply some extra DC voltage to those Schottkys to really make them a short circuit. Even so, with the amount of isolation you're going to get with those Schottky diodes, let me drop.
2HWW, want to comment on this subject?
Yeah, stand by, Howie. I'm going to want to complete a whole thought here. The thing I'm concerned about is that while you're transmitting, even with the Schottky diodes in the front of the receiver cutting down the signal drastically into the receiver, because your receiver is in the same room with you, inches or feet away from that transmitter, the total amount of signal strength in microvolts going into that receiver is such that the receiver is going to be developing a very high automatic gain control voltage. Therefore, when you go from the transmit mode to the receive mode, until you bleed off that automatic gain control voltage, the receiver will be dead. So an additional circuit is going to be required to kill the AGC voltage on the receiver rapidly when you go back to the receive mode, because your receiver is going to be saturated when you transmit. When the receiver is in the same room with you, unless the receiver is the world's best shielded box with all kinds of fancy TR circuitry, that receiver is going to be strongly overloaded while you're transmitting. I'll bet you you've experienced some of that with the experiments you've done already. Is that true, Red Joe? Rich, WB2GSM, K2LIW in the TechNet?
Yes, the coupling capacitor is attached to the plate or the cathode. By the way, DXQ is gridlocked.
Okay, so it uses gridlock keying. However, when the key is up, I'm guessing because the tube runs Class C and or because of gridlock keying, my guess is the tube is thoroughly non-conductive, and you need that. If the tube was in the Class A conducting mode, it would be one hell of a noise generator into that receiver, even though it's not obvious. The tube itself has got, let me pick a number, a 20 dB noise figure in that mode of operation. So I presume that you have experienced high AGC voltage development, receiver overload when you transmit, and therefore when you lift up the key, there's some number of milliseconds required before the receiver becomes back active again when it drains away that AGC voltage. Is that approximately what you've experienced up to now, Joe? WB2GSM, K2RIW?
I've experienced that. I'm going to tackle that problem separate from the VR problem. Again, the capacitor, the coupling capacitor is attached where? The anode or the cathode?
Anode, of course. You want the Pi network playing the signal backwards on reception from the antenna. You want that voltage coming back into the plate circuit of the tube. That's what the receiver signal is doing. And now that coupling capacitor on the is on the plate of the tube, which is the C1 capacitor input end of the Pi network. Is that a little bit more clear, Rich? Go ahead.
Got it. Nailed it.
For the joke.
Great. Thank you.
I'm sure I haven't got you. Your call letters, Rich, are Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf Sierra Mike. Is that true?
Golf X-ray Mike.
That's why I can't find you. Oh, okay. Alrighty, so as you can tell, when it comes to very fast TR circuits for full break-in, there's multiple ways of doing it. You've taken the direct approach with real TR relays. Solid-state TR relay. Let me drop it. And even with that, a carefully done circuit, you're still going to experience receiver overload. I think you're going to have to use caging of the AGC. You're going to have to cage the AGC voltage. In other words, when you're in the transmit mode, you're going to have to clamp the AGC voltage of the receiver to some convenient number so that when you go back to the receive mode, you don't have to wait lots of milliseconds for the AGC voltage to drain away so that the receiver becomes back alive again. Whenever a receiver is in the same room with you on the same band, to stop the receiver from becoming overloaded with your own transmitter is a very difficult problem. If the receiver was next door in another house 100 feet away, you'd stand a chance. When it's a couple of feet away on the same table with you, without heroic techniques, that receiver is going to see a mountainous big signal. The receiver is made for a fraction of a microvolt of reception, and you're giving it potentially great big volts, if you know what I mean, which is millions of times larger. Howie, I wonder if you've done full break-in. I wonder if you've got some comments on this. WB2-HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comments here, Dick. I was going to talk about the diode, but yeah, you're right. I remember with the straight 4 line, it has an R4BT4XB. If you ran that in full break-in, you had to wait like an eighth of a second. You would see the S meter all the way over at 60, and then it would come right back down to the ALC. You had to go with the fast, fast ADC, I mean, fast ADC. Dick, here's the situation. I would still rather use a neon circuit, and what Hal was saying, and I agree with him, is you go through a tube amplifier, then into your receiver. If you try to use back-to-back diodes, they can cause nonlinear effects and you can get intermod. I had an issue with 10 meters where I was trying to protect a gas FET, a 3SK121, whatever it was, inside of a 10 meter receiver. And I went to, I used shortage stubs because every time we had a lightning storm, I would lose the front end. And I put a pair of diodes across it, and I will tell you that I got like intermod. So I would probably use a neon, because a neon is not going to give you intermodulation. It's not going to give you that kind of a situation. Or I would use the RCA dual gate MOSFET. I remember back in 1969 when Clay came out with their fancy Clay 22 Mark II. It had, a 40736 or a 40376 was one of those. It was the hottest device around. It had built-in Schottky diode. Do you remember that device, Dick?
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit here, Howie. Without a doubt, if you're running a tube-type receiver on any two tube with its 60 volts of firing voltage, it's going to protect your tube-type receiver. But the 60 volts that the NE2 allows to flow through of RF energy is going to, I don't think there's any FET-like transistor that can tolerate that without damage, unless it also has some protection diodes inside. To use the Schottky diodes back-to-back to protect is going to protect the receiver. if the RF signal you're listening to happens to be more than, let me pick a number, 0.2 volts at the receiver input, and the diodes start conducting, yes, they're going to be making intermods. If you decide that your particular FET input receiver, let me drop it. If you decide that your particular FET input receiver could, for instance, take 3 volts without damage, and you've got your back-to-back Schottky diodes, and if you back-bias each of those diodes by -3 volts, now they don't start conducting until 3.2 volts of signal comes along, so to speak. So there's ways that you can get the protection of the Schottky diodes, and yet in a strong signal environment, like many of your pieces of electronics are located in some very strong signal requirements, so strong signal environments, and therefore your Schottkys are going to be harmonic generators, unless you back bias them by the 3 volts that I gave in this example. So there's ways around that where you can have your cake and eat it too. In other words, protect the receiver front end, and yet not for reasonable local signal strength, not create harmonics. I'll bet you you've done some back biasing of back-to-back diodes on the front end receivers, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, my experience with doing stuff like that is a VHF. I tend to use pin diodes, so I have never actually tried it at HF, but I see where you're going, and it makes perfect sense. But I'm still a fan of, even at HF, you know, the quarter wave lump network as a way to isolate it using an added diode straight to ground. So that's just my take on it. Even with a two circuit, I'd still do something like that.
KKRIW. Go in. Well, you know what you could do? You could use something like a 6CW4. Use a Vista. You could put, it won't destroy itself if it gets hit with some voltage, and you could use a neon bulb. Believe it or not, a lot of the Motorola used to put a neon bulb across the receiver on low band to protect it from lightning. If you, I don't know what transistors, but Motorola used to use a neon bulb, an NE2 or something like that, that would be, you would see it right near the antenna jack that they would use to protect the front end from lightning discharges or from static. Go ahead, Dick.
But you know, you can stop 40 volts with a 6AU4 and laugh at you.
Like a 6CW4 or 6AU4, but I'm just saying, Motorola used to use a neon bulb in some of their equipment to protect it. If you look at, let's say, a Voltrac or even a Micor low-band mobile, they have a neon bulb across the input stick.
What standard in all the green light receivers? Those were the two receivers.
With the right kind of Schottky and similar diodes, pin diodes or whatever, there's ways of protecting a solid-state front end. If you want to use a brute force technique, you can take your solid-state receiver and put a tube preamplifier in front of it. And the nice thing about tubes is that on the grid of that tube, you can put a monstrous big voltage, and even a lightning strike, it might survive, but monstrous big signals, RF signals, and the tube will laugh at you. So it would be a weird mixture of old-fashioned and brand-new circuitry to take a modern-day state-of-the-art solid-state receiver and put a tube preamplifier in front of it to protect it. I know it can be done with Schottky diodes, back by a Schottky diodes. Every FET-like transistor in your RF front end has a manufacturer-recommended maximum voltage on that gate or on that, on that gate where hopefully it does not create any damage. And with the right kind of Schottky diodes back-to-back with biasing in front of it, you can make sure that that voltage is not exceeded and protected. So you've got quite a project there, Rich. Please check in with us periodically and let us know of all the multiple approaches to your particular problem to make full break-in. Those words roll off the lips real easily. Let me drop it.
Dick, I use Schottky diodes in the amplifier that I created because of the speed.
So in your case, you're doing your switching with Schottky diodes because you want to switch in fractions of a microsecond, I believe. So full break-in with full receiver. of sensitivity during the braking, in between the dots and the dashes. It's easy to say those words. To really make it work, the total system, you got to be kind of sophisticated. It's a bit of a minefield there, but I sense you've got a handle on a lot of it, Rich. So check in with us periodically and let us know how this project is going. Then we meet your GSM with some finals on the K2IW and the TechNet. You've got it there, Rich.
Breaks WW with a further comment.
Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
You're right. Lots of chew on, but that's what I signed up for, and it's actually a lot. It's pretty enjoyable wading through all of it. And thank you, Eric. Thank you. Thank you all you guys for your input. I'm going to work on this, and I'm going to be researching a lot more. And happy 4th of July to all of you. Dick and the TechNet, Rich WPGF.
Two very quick questions there, Rich. How many watts are you running right now? Because you're a little bit noisy into the repeater. And your Morse code speed. Are you a 20 words a minute code speed person? Over to you, Rich.
Right now I'm on the ocean. I think it's 4 watts. And as for Morse code, back in the day, I think I did 20 words per minute. I certainly got the advanced with it.
Well done. What did you do between the second ago transmitter and the last transmission? What did you do to make your signal so much not noisy? Did you go to higher power, or did you hold the handy in a different location? Over to you, Rich.
Been using the motion since the second transmission. I'm also using a Heil headset with it. And the Heil headset, I think, helps a lot with this particular HD.
Yeah, your Heil headset has got something to do with the quality of your audio. Your RF energy getting into the repeater three transmissions ago was very weak, very noisy. You were very noisy RF-wise. What did you do to put out more RF voltage? Was it a handy talkie that you held differently? Is it a handy talkie that runs higher power? Are you using an external antenna? What did you do to boost your RF signal so much on the last two transmissions? Over to you, Rich.
HT with its rubber ducky. I probably moved it closer to the window and held it up a little bit, and I'm hitting the mic.
Well done. Holding it up a little bit near the window gives us a lot more RF. Inside your house, as you know, you can tell when you're receiving a repeater that as you move around the room, you hear hot spots and cold spots when you're receiving. Well, you're transmitting on a slightly different frequency, and the hot spots and the cold spots in the room are in different locations. So holding it a little higher near the window did the job beautifully. Howie, you want to make a last comment on this? WV2HWW, K2IW, the TechNet.
Nick, I don't know if you heard what I said about Motorola using a neon bulb, and I would use it, you know, that's the way I would do it. Probably the simplest way to do it. But try to do diodes. You could do backward biasing, but then you have to, you know, use RF chokes and all of that kind of stuff. But it's pretty simple. But you got to be careful about what you said about the AGC. Back to you, Dick. Did you copy my comment about what Motorola used to do with their receivers?
We heard that both times, and Eric also approached that. Now, the neon bulb for a tube front end Motorola equipment gives you good protection from lightning and whatever. But the neon bulb takes 60 or 70 volts before it starts conducting. You put 60 or 70 volts of RF into a set front end low noise amplifier, and there's a high probability you're going to damage it. So that's not enough protection, in my opinion. I hope we haven't gone beyond the bedtime of John, KD2IXD, Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa. Hope you're still awake, John. Over to you, K2RIW and the TechNet.
KD2IXP. I've been asleep for about 20 minutes. I'm looking for some assistance from somebody. I have three PL259s. Solder onto a Belden 9913 wire can't get my wheelchair outside to where two of the connections have to be soldered. Does anybody know anybody who does that kind of thing? I have no objection to paying for it, but that's the kind of thing I need. I live in Jericho on the border of Sahasa, not far from L&L. And if anybody knows anybody who does that kind of thing, I would appreciate it.
So as you can tell, John needs some soldering of PL-259 onto his 9913 coax cable. John lives in the town of Jericho, and Jericho on my map is roughly halfway between Syosset and Hicksville, very close to the Long Island Expressway. When it comes to properly installing PL-259, my favorite way to do it, when I'm doing it with RG-8, I'm not sure now whether or not this will work on 9913, which has got an air semiconductor, an air insulator between the semiconductor and the shield. But in the case of RG-8, RG-9, RG-214, the usual diameter of coax cable with a real plastic-like insulation between. Let me drop. Lots of people make the mistake of screwing on. First, you screw on the nut. You put the nut on the cable first, then you screw on the body of the connector. And then through the four holes, you try to solder. Well, if you've got a big enough iron and enough solder so that you really get in there and solder down all of those leads of the braid that are in between the four holes, that amount of heat is going to be melting the daylight out of your dielectric in that coax cable. And it makes a pretty ugly mess. The average guy just solders the four holes, and he's picking up a couple of the wires of the shield. And the rest of the wires are not bound in any way. And he's not getting very good mechanical connection. He's not getting very good RF connection. It is my favorite way to put on a PL-259 that you trim the cable first and tin all of the braid. You tin all of the braid all the way around. Because it's out in open air, you can easily do that without damaging the dielectric material. Now when you want to screw on the body of the connector, because you're now screwing on over top of tinned braid, it requires a hell of a lot more force. Let me drop it. You need a pretty large set of pliers to do that job, but it's doable. If you've done a neat job of tinning, and you use a good set of pliers to screw on that body of the connector, you now have the four holes looking at tinned braid, and now when you do some soldering through those four holes, you're picking up all of that braid, if you know what I mean. Because even though you don't melt it all the way between the holes, because it's already tinned, it is essentially connecting, if you know what I mean. Now you get a very strong mechanical joint and a very high RF integrity of PL-259. PL-59 is a beautiful high-power connector. All of the nasty words that people have said about it all of these years, let me drop it. That connector has been around for roughly 1940. That connector has been around for 75 years. It's got a lot of history. It's a good high-power connector. It doesn't arc over. Got a very, very low insertion loss. All of these stories about half a dB insertion loss for each PL-259, pure hogwash. The only fault I have with a PL-259 is it's not very good at weatherproofing. You have to do a lot of tape wrapping and whatever. A properly installed type N connector, UG21, has a built-in rubber washer which does a very good job of weatherproofing. A PL-259 doesn't have that, so the only thing you got to worry about PL-259 is make sure you're keeping the water out of it in your outdoor environment. Other than that, it's a beautiful connector. So, as you can tell, John needs somebody to come to his abode and install those connectors, or I guess it's even possible. Let me drop. I'm going to ask John this question. If those cables that you want the PL-259s on are not installed on the tower and installed in the house, so to speak, if they are called coiled cables that are capable of being moved now, then you stand a chance of bringing Muhammad to the mountain as opposed to bringing the mountain to Muhammad, if you know what I mean. In other words, the TechNet.
Yes, actually, they have to be done here. The technique you described with tinning the braid, that's something I learned when I went to the HRU. And I can do this, but I can't do this because I can't get the wheelchair out to the outside of the house where it has to be done. I have several pieces of electrical insulation, electrical weatherproof that's very sticky and will seal the connections very well. They cost me like seven pieces. So I'm not worried about, you know, making them weathertight. I'm just worried about getting to them, doing it.
So right now, as you can tell, John needs a volunteer. Somebody who's willing to come to his QTH. He's a little bit west of Route 135, a little bit north of the expressway. He's in the town of Jericho. Could say he's roughly halfway between Fayas and Hicksville, so that pins down his location. John needs a volunteer to come and install the PL259 connectors on his three or four or five pieces of 9913 coaxial cable. So, do we have a volunteer out there? So, give me a call with us right now. Keep your eyes up in the TechNet. We're listening.
K2IWT to UPS Mobile, Pennsylvania. He's been working my backyard, Dick. Assuming he has a soldering iron, I could bring an extension cord to get the soldering iron outside to do it. I don't know if I could get to it this week. I don't know what type of time frame he's looking at, though.
Very fine there, Rich. I'm guessing you're in Pennsylvania. You might be heading west. We're going to hear that, about that on your next transmission. Yes, he's almost in your backyard. He's within bicycle driving distance. Not quite walking distance, I think. And so, who supplies the soldering iron and the electrical power for it, the extension cord? Those are minor details, as I see it, for a guy who is as well-equipped as you are, Rich. So, see what kind of time frame, and I know that you sometimes have some relatively crazy hours when you're home and when you're back on the road. Find out what hours John is available for you to supply the service. KD2IXP, we've got a volunteer. K2IW TechNet, you've got it, John.
I have a micro torch. I have a hand torch. I have soldering iron. Weller, heavy duty soldering irons. I've got all the supplies necessary. I've got the. I even have some of the old 6040 rosin core. I have the new stuff. And 37 solder. I've got everything I need to do the job, but the physical ability to get to the job. I've got, you know, wire cutters, the curved wire cutters. I've got everything. I just can't get to the job.
John, when it comes to soldering, I strongly recommend that you do not use an open flame of any kind, because the open flame will take the materials you're going to solder and create copper oxide immediately, and then soldering goes a lot more difficult. Also, when it comes to solders for a job like this, I recommend the old-fashioned 6040 or Utexic solder, but real lead-tin solder. The so-called modern solders, the Rojas, you know, removal of hazardous material solders, I strongly recommend you do not use that. It requires fancy fluxes, it requires a lot more heat, it's a lot more difficult to use, and it's a lot less reliable, particularly outdoors.